Welcome back to the Emerge podcast. Today I'm joined by Daniel Schmachtenberger. Daniel is a social engineer and evolutionary philosopher and strategist. He is the founder of Critical Path Institute, the Emergence Project, and the co-founder of the Neurohacker Collective. Daniel has become very well known in the weird corner of the internet that this podcast occupies, the sense-making media, the meta-media, whatever we're going to call it. In any case, for me personally, Daniel's thinking has colored many of the conversations I've had on the podcast, and his formulations, his kind of abstractions, have been named by many of the people that I have talked with. Daniel is a close collaborator with folks I've had on the show, people like Jordan Greenhall and Zach Stein. Daniel was also kind enough to offer to come back on the show if there are any follow-up questions that people have. If, while you're listening to the conversation or after you finish listening to the conversation, you have some questions, some curiosities that you'd like to hear Daniel reflect on, you can send them to me on Twitter. I'm at dthorson. Or you can email them to me. I'm at dthorson@gmail.com. I will collate those questions, find a way to kind of rank them and prioritize them, and then maybe we'll do a sort of AMA episode with Daniel sometime in the future. Who knows? All right, without further ado, here is Daniel Schmachtenberger on the Emerge podcast. The Emerge podcast is proud to be sponsored by the Monastic Academy for the Preservation of Life on Earth. The Monastic Academy, located in Lowell, Vermont, is a training center dedicated to the amplification of human maturity in the age of the Anthropocene. The Academy trains its participants through a unique combination of rigorous contemplative training, project-based learning, and a disciplined commitment to ethical behavior, all held in the context of deep community. The Monastic Academy is currently accepting applications for the apprenticeship program. This program, lasting 2 or 3 months, includes silent retreats, daily meditation instruction, and regular authentic relating practices. This program is free. Other ways to participate include daily visits, week-long retreats, or, if you can work remotely, joining the Academy through the co-working program, allowing you to deepen your practice while keeping your job. For more information, you can go to www.monasticacademy.com. Welcome back to Emerge. Today on the show, I am very excited to welcome for the first time Daniel Schmachtenberger. Daniel, welcome to Emerge.
Thanks for having me, Daniel. Happy to be here.
Yeah, so your thinking and I guess what you've shared on the internet as you've been wrestling with our era has already flavored many of the conversations we've had on the show with people like Jordan Greenhall, Hansi Freinacht, Bonita Roy. You know, your thinking has in various ways informed those conversations. And so this conversation is going to assume some degree of background knowledge about your approach to the kinds of inquiries this show is all about: collapse, phase shift, human potential. Yeah, and to start off, I think I would love to hear your take on what I think of as the kind of current state of play. You know, my sense as an observer of culture is that things seem to be accelerating as they have, but there's a kind of like, I don't know, some sort of point that's been reached, pivot point or something, you know, collapse is puncturing the mainstream discourse. You can look at the New York Times article on the rebranding of the Pinkertons to be kind of like a post-collapse militia. You can look at Jem Bendel's deep adaptation paper getting just more attention than like any other academic paper that gets published. And it wasn't even published. It was just put on the internet. Or the fact that Extinction Rebellion is gathering so much steam. And I'm curious, like, what are you seeing now? And if there's anything that has changed in your models or expectations or sense of how collapse or phase shift will unfold?
Yeah. So you're mentioning that the general zeitgeist is getting more familiar with and considerate about collapse models. And I think thinking about the emergence of that phenomena historically is kind of interesting. So there have been some people talking about something like an imminent phase shift that would either look like collapse or emergence forever, right? I mean, for a very long time. And that's the way I think about it is that's a way of thinking about the biblical rapture story. It's a way of being able to interpret the end of the Mayan calendar or the end of Kali Yuga and the beginning of Satyuga in the Hindu system is that the idea that we're in a time that doesn't continue the way that this time has been unfolding and that at a certain point there's something like a hard fork, we can see that being a pretty old idea, right? Yeah. And kind of the way I think about that, and I'm thinking about it metaphorically, I don't know what the actual history was, but let's imagine that we're thinking about kind of the rapture story from Christian and, you know, even earlier Jewish kind of thinking. So if we were people like you and I having a conversation like this where we're thinking about the future during the Bronze Age, and we're noticing that as we've continued to develop more powerful technology, we have developed more powerful technology of warfare. So, you know, as soon as we get arrows, and then as soon as we get arrows that can pierce armor and, you know, armor and all those things, that there's an escalation of military capacity on all sides, and we can kill a lot more people from further distances than the records of previous warfare. And it's pretty clear that we're going to keep developing more projectile capacity and, you know, we're going to get catapults and then cannons and whatever. And we're also developing technology for accumulation, being able to store resources so that there's more of an orientation to accumulate surplus and the ability to extract resources, everything from, you know, better saws to take trees down and better fishing technology to, you know, smithing technology. And so we can see that as our technology's growing, both our capacity to kill each other and our capacity to unrenewably destroy the environment. And so we see that there are deserts near our civilization that are the results of our unrenewable agriculture and forestry practices, and they're growing. And that the military technology we're getting that's upratcheting is also upratcheting on the other sides. And it's not that hard to just kind of run the scenario and say, okay, if we keep increasing our technology and using it in ways that directly harm each other or indirectly harm the commons, we just don't get to do that forever on a finite playing field. And so there's a reckoning that's going to come with how we use power as we keep getting more powerful. And so we get the kind of purgatory story that there's right now, it's only a few prescient people, prophets, that see that it's going to go this way. But there's a certain point at which the fact that we don't get to keep going this way becomes eminently obvious to everyone. And if we continue to try and use our power in game theoretic ways that advantage self at the expense of other or commons, and in doing so, we have to get some asymmetric power over the others seeking to do that. And the moment we deploy the asymmetric power, it gets reverse engineered and iterated on, so all sides are exponentially upratcheting power that is used to externalize harm. As soon as that becomes imminent, then there's this kind of great reckoning of if we keep doing that, we don't get to keep doing that in a sustainable way. So we get something like a collapse and a hell scenario. And to get something like a not collapse scenario, we have to be safe stewards for our power. And we don't really have any record of the thing we call civilization using our power all that well, right? Meaning we've of course used power to do some lovely things and a bunch of dreadful things. But if we take the distribution of the types of choices that we made as Sumerians or Romans or British or Egyptians or whatever, and we multiply the power of how we've made choices by an exponential set of capacities, that self-terminates everywhere. Because, and this is where the mythopoetics of heaven on earth or the consciousness change that would have to come comes in, which is, if technology gives us something like the power of gods, we have to have something like the love and wisdom of gods to be able to rightly wield it. Otherwise, the misapplication of that power self-terminates. And so I think that metaphor holds quite strongly. And I think we can kind of think of it as that we're entering something like the purgatory phase, where rather than a few prescient people recognizing it, you kind of have to be not paying attention to recognize it. And whether we're looking at climate change, or we're looking at biodiversity loss or species extinction, or specific cases like loss of, you know, pollinators or issues with coral, or getting to, you know, peak oil, peak nitrogen, peak resources of different types, or we're looking at the effects of exponential terrorism or exponential warfare, or the massive human migration issues that could be occurring, or even accidental externalities from more powerful tech like AI or CRISPR and biotech. It's not like there's one collapse scenario. It's like there's lots and lots and lots of them. And even if we protect it against several of them, all that does is move the curve of when the collapse happens by a tiny bit, because we're developing power on all fronts and using it in ways where we're advantaging some metrics, meaning either advantaging some in-group at the expense of out-groups, advantaging the near-term at the expense of the long-term, advantaging a particular metric like GDP at the expense of other metrics like biodiversity. And as long as we are advantaging some things at the expense of other things with exponentially more capacity to do so, that's going to be self-terminating across all of the applications of the power. And so, yeah, I think it is fair to say that we're moving into a place where at least there is a general sensibility of this that is increasing. And even amongst some smaller populations, like people on your, you know, listenership probably, some deeper understanding that it's not one scenario, it's a lot of scenarios, and it's not the result of a few bad, dumb people. It's actually the result of the structure of civilization itself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so I'd be curious, I believe that you've read Jem Bendel's deep adaptation paper, and he was on the show, and we explored together his sense of what he calls the inevitable near-term collapse of social systems due to climate change. And obviously that's just one factor of collapse, right? Is ecological related collapse. And so that question of like, we're past the point of no return and now it's sort of inevitable. A lot of people I hear are looking at this situation that way, that we're kind of past this point of no return. How do you relate to that possibility? Is that something you're tracking? And like, do you agree with that? Yeah, I'm curious what your thoughts are.
I think that we're past the point of no return in terms of that the type of world order that we have and the underlying civilization architectures are definitely going to collapse. That doesn't mean that the biosphere and our species has to collapse with it. It just means that if our species is going to not collapse with it, it has to figure out new systems for mediating itself, right? And so I'm not fatalistic about this. I'm looking at which civilizations can't further, which systems can't further from an architectural perspective. So like, there's a bunch of things worth looking at. First, we should make the distinction between an existential risk and a catastrophic risk, meaning if we describe an existential risk as an extinction, a lack of lack to continue our existence as a species, there are risks that could be fully existential to Homo sapien, or even fully existential to, say, all mammals or all hydrocarbon life. But I don't think there's that many of them that are all that probable currently. Then there are catastrophic risks where it's like, okay, we're talking about some humans in pockets making it through a World War scenario or environmental collapse scenario, but we lose so much of what we have developed as a civilization. And I think there are a lot more scenarios that are more likely of that class. But for now, I would just put them all together as, massive to complete collapse type scenarios. So if we look at climate change, for instance, I don't think there are any climate change scenarios that very reasonably are existential, meaning that we create a climate where that is Venus formed, where humans just can't live in the climate. I don't think that is likely. So I do think we can have a situation where environmental issues that include climate change, but also include desertification and fishery collapse and resource issues of various kinds, lead to massive human migrations. And that those massive human migrations lead to really significantly increased resource pressures, which definitely have a good chance of leading to war and escalating war and economic collapse and grid collapse and those types of things.
Yeah. And so, in the Future Thinkers podcasts, it's really important to listen to. It's one of the most important podcasts I think I've ever heard, in my estimation. And in that podcast, you talk about this idea of scaled interpersonal coherence as being a kind of solution to the current problem set or problematic architecture of our civilization. And I'm curious if there's anywhere that you now see signs of the emergence of this sort of collective intelligence, you know, the one that could help us thread this needle. I understand you may not be able to name the specifics because these things are often very fragile when they're getting going. But even just to know that you're seeing like embryonic versions of what you've been calling for would be, just curious to hear if that is happening yet in your view.
Okay. So when you were talking about solutions in terms of new types of collective intelligence and sense-making systems that could inform new types of choice-making, new social architectures, to be able to look at what an adequate social architecture would be, we do need to understand adequacy. We do need to understand the nature of the problems in current social architecture. And you mentioned that a number of those were discussed in Future Thinkers in ways that took a while. So I won't take a while with it, but I think it might be worth just briefly naming what the primary issues are so that then we could say, emergent experiments that would be interesting would be things that would address these types of issues. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So briefly, we were just mentioning that there's a lot of different types of risks that emerge from the same underlying dynamics. I've talked about these underlying dynamics as generator functions, which means we're not looking at a particular type of pollution or a particular type of resource depletion or a particular type of warfare. We're looking at what creates pollution or resource depletion or warfare writ large in the nature of how humans coordinate activity. And if we can identify underneath all of the future risk scenarios, we can identify, a hopefully relatively small set of social architectures or generator functions that give rise to all those problems, then we can say, well, rather than solve for the instance of a particular collapse scenario, can we solve for the class of the generator functions writ large? And if we could find a finite set of generator functions that we could show to be subsumptive, that all of the risks come from these things, and we could actually solve for the class of those generator functions, then that would be the kernel of a new civilization model. Mm-hmm. And a civilization that would be by its design parameters, not self-terminating. Mm-hmm. And so we'll just kind of describe that real quick. There's a lot of ways to think about why a particular system that is autopoietic, right? That's self-organizing and self-advancing, why it would self-terminate. But it's not uncommon. If we think about cancer in a body, cancer is a autopoietic, self-terminating thing, right? Mm-hmm. So the cancer cells figure figure that they can defect on the rest of the body. I am saying this in an anthropomorphic way, but they defect on the agreement of the rest of the body in a way that has them actually gain more resources. They consume sugar faster than the surrounding cells and they replicate faster. So they're doing an increased consumption and reproduction. But in doing so, they're actually debasing the integrity of the entire system. And if they succeed, if the rest of the system doesn't reverse them, you know, stop them doing that, then you actually have the most cancer cells right before the body dies. And then they all die. And so as they are in the short term advancing what it seems like is their mission, they are also debasing the substrate upon which they depend. And because the cancer cells emerge out of a healthy body that can live for a lot longer than a cancerous body can. And so in general, we can say that if you have any system that emerges out of a base layer, a more fundamental layer, if that emergent layer debases the layer that it emerges out of and depends upon, that system's going to self-terminate eventually, right? You can't debase your own substrate sustainably. Right. Well, we can see that nature gives rise to humans. We see that humans give rise to technology, and then humans use the tech to kill each other, debase nature, and make better tech to do both of those things. That's an unstable scenario. And so if we want to have stability of creatures that have the amount of power that technology enables us to have that is totally unprecedented in the rest of life, then if nature gives rise to humans and humans give rise to tech, the tech has to be in service to the actual resilience of nature so that there is a closed resiliency loop. Well, building technology and infrastructure with the goal of increasing the orderly complexity and the metastability and anti-fragility of nature itself is not something we've really ever done, but it's something we obviously have to do, right? And so we can start thinking about what currently is underneath how we develop tech. There's both a set of motivation structures, economic structures, and a type of sense-making. We develop a particular piece of technology for a particular goal, but it's going to interact with a lot of things other than the goal for which we made it, which are areas that can create externality of harm, right? So there's both a change of the motivation of how we do technology, the comprehensivity of it, the nature of the sense-making process that would have to change for us to be able to do tech properly. So thinking about a civilization that is debasing its own substrate, self-terminating, is just so people kind of get a sense of why self-termination, you know, would happen in that way. A simple way of thinking about the generator functions that a generator function that I think is familiar to most people is just the topic of perverse incentive writ large, the idea of what perverse incentive is, which is if we want to look at biodiversity loss and we say, okay, why are we extincting so many species and why are the large fish species so overfished and the whales and why have we cut down so many of the trees? As soon as we have a system where the trees are worth more dead as lumber than they are alive, or the fish are worth more dead than they are swimming in the ocean, and war raises GDP and is more profitable than peace, and sick people are more profitable than healthy people, then, and on and on, underneath all of those problems is a perverse incentive complex where someone has a lot more incentive to cause a problem than they do to not cause a problem, right? And if we take a look at the dead trees example, we get this multipolar trap where me cutting down this tree or these few trees is not killing all forests, but it is getting my family meaningfully ahead. And my, if I leave them, my family doesn't get ahead and doesn't even eat, right? And if I do this, then my family gets ahead. And so I don't think about it at kind of a great debasing our whole substrate scale. And I don't even think I have options because I don't necessarily know another way other than cutting the trees down. And if I don't cut the trees down, someone else is going to cut the trees down. So I don't even have an option to leave them. And so if someone else is going to cut them down anyways, then I might as well do it to be able to get my family to move forward. So we have a situation in which each person or each company or each country acting in its own rational near-term self-interest leads And so each person doing what actually seems smart to them in the near term is actually suicidal for the whole over the long term. It's a dysfunctional collective intelligence where the coupling of the choices of the individual actors doesn't couple to good choices at the level of the whole system, right? Yeah. So we have a system where, for the most part, nobody really wants climate change. There are some examples that there are some exceptions that matter. Like, you know, if I was Russia, I would be pretty stoked on climate change because the opening up of the Northern Passage would be economically powerful. But for the most part, nobody wants climate change. And yet all of us are doing actions that are advancing climate change. And but in our own self-interest, I need to just put some gas in the car to drive. And what I'm doing is so tiny relative to the whole thing, and on, whether it's an individual actor, a corporate actor, military actor, and in the presence of what everybody else is doing. And so there's this weird thing where the invisible hand of the market, the emergent property of everybody interacting, where they're all doing utility maximization within a current system, is perpetuating the system. So the invisible hand of the market is driving climate change and driving biodiversity loss and up-ratcheting exponential warfare, even though no actual actors really want any of those things. Mm-hmm. And that is a dysfunctional collective intelligence, right? But basically a scenario where we have game theoretic actors, whether it's an individual person or a family or a tribe or a nation state or a corporation or a political party or a race that identifies as an in-group in competition for scarce resources with some other out-group, if they're acting in their own interest, then and they're empowered by the ability to create technology, whether we're talking about social technology like democracy or markets or physical technology like extraction capacity from the environment or information tech or warfare tech. The difference between humans and all the rest of animals in nature in this way, because obviously in nature, there's a lot of cooperation, there's a lot of symbiosis, but there's also competition and there are rivalrous dynamics. And we might see two animals of the same species actually competing over reproductive opportunity in a rivalrous way, and even in a zero-sum way. And we might see a predator and prey in a zero-sum dynamic, one specific predator hunting one prey animal. And yet we still see this kind of meta-stability in nature. And so we take this idea that, you know, hey, the lions chasing the gazelle eat the slow gazelle. They don't catch the fast one. So then the fastest of the gazelles are the ones that reproduce, and the gazelles get faster as a result of what the lions are doing. So, hey, this rivalry is actually good. The competition drives innovation. The lions as a whole, if they weren't there, the gazelles would actually overpopulate themselves into extinction. So the gazelles need the lions, and the lions make the gazelles better. And the speed of the gazelles getting away a lot of the time has the slow lions starve. So the fast lions get faster, and, you know, et cetera. And so we see that this rivalry and this competition is actually necessary because they couldn't maintain without it. And it upratchets everybody's capacity and drives this thing called evolution. And so we're like, okay, well, that's how nature works. So we should work that way. And hey, that's how theory of markets works, right? And this is basically a simple way of understanding social Darwinism, where we reify theory of markets as if it's a Darwinian process. And we say evolution is defined by an environmental niche and then selection dynamics inside of that niche. And the selection dynamics are a result of three things: mutation, survival selection, and mate selection. So the mutation happens randomly in evolution, right? It's not consciously controlled where a lion gets to say, I want my DNA to mutate in this way. It just mutation occurs from gamma rays, from oxidative stress, from copying errors, from whatever. And so some mutations lead to a slightly longer neck. And if that is advantageous because there are leaves up high that aren't being eaten and a couple that have a similar mutation breed together, that moves in a direction towards giraffes, right? But most mutations won't be advantageous and most of them will fail. So we have basically mutation, and then which mutations survive? Most of them aren't going to survive. They're not even going to be able to eat. And then of the ones that survive, they mate with each other, and only those genetics, only those offspring go through. So for something to be selected for long term, it has to survive and it has to be able to reproduce. So we think about markets and we say, well, demand, in a supply and demand dynamic, demand is like an environmental niche. There is some resource there. And something is going to emerge to fill that niche, to create a source of supply. So then it's usually not one something, it's a number of somethings competing. And so you get multiple people or companies trying to make a product or service to fulfill that demand, but they do slightly different versions. They have their own innovations, and that's like mutation, right? Slight modifications on the product. And so most of the companies are going to fail. And only the company that actually figures out how to provide the best value at the best price is the one that's going to make it through, i.e. survival selection. And then maybe you got a couple companies that are doing something really positive. And if they were to join IP, it'd be even better. So you get a merger or an acquisition. And that's like kind of mate dynamics where you get recombinatorial dynamics on the underlying innovations. And so we say, well, great. So markets drive innovation. And as a result of they drive innovation and the competition pressure is actually a healthy, good thing. And that's how we get new tech. And that's how we actually get higher quality of life for everybody. This is, of course, not true at all and silly, even though like it's not true at all. There is some truth to it. But the reason that it is fundamentally not true and we can't model ourselves in a Darwinian way is because the other animals can't up-ratchet their rivalrous capacity with technology, and that really changes everything. And so if we look at an apex predator, say we take an orca or a lion or a polar bear, one lion just can't do that much harm to all lions or to all gazelles or to its whole ecosystem. It's just not that powerful. But one person today with nuclear weapons or biotech can really fuck a lot of stuff up. And so the system becomes very fragile when one person or one group has so much power relative to the entire system, right? Our technologies allowed us to upratchet our power relative to each other and relative to the other species and relative to the system as a whole in a way that nothing in evolution has anything even closely resembling. And so you think about a great white and its ability to catch fish. And then you think about an ocean trawler with a mile long drift net and its ability to catch fish. And you're like, oh, we are clearly not apex predators. We can't model ourselves as apex predators anymore, because if we keep competing for who's apex predator in that way, but we can pull up miles of fish at once, we clearly debase the planet's ability to support us. And so the key thing to really get is that in nature, the mutations that lead to advantage are symmetrically distributed across the entire ecosystem. So all lions are undergoing mutation and all gazelles are, and there's similarity from some lions to others, and there's similarity in the mutation dynamics between the lions and the gazelles and also the everything else. So you never get the lions getting 1,000 times more powerful in one step, irrespective of the gazelles having a similar step. If they did, you would actually lose the metastability of the whole system. The lion's going to get a tiny bit faster, or the gazelle will get a tiny bit faster through a mutation. As that happens, then the slowest of the gazelles will get eaten. The faster ones will now rebreed and combine. And so you get this thing where power increases anywhere lead to power increases everywhere, because there's a symmetry in the distribution of power. So that's a result of the symmetrical distribution of mutation pressures and the co-selective pressures. The fact that as one is elevating, it is having real-time interaction with the other one, so they're also elevating, which is why an invasive species can ruin a whole ecosystem, is that it didn't have co-selective pressure. So if we bring an invasive species in that figured out how to have some kind of power that the whole ecosystem is not adapted to deal with, it can really massively fuck up a system. Well, us developing the kind of tech that we have makes us like a super invasive species across every ecosystem with nothing ever being able to really check that capacity. And so this is where when we recognize no other animal has the ability to destroy whole ecosystems or build new types of ecosystems or genetically engineer new species and hybridize new species and extinct species. So We don't have power like apex predators where we can model ourselves that way and all do our own competitive dynamics. We have power to affect the world that really only nature had previously. And nature is tending to the orderly complexity of the whole. So if we have that much power, it has to be used to actually tend to the orderly complexity and the metastability of the whole or bust, right? And this very much goes back to this kind of earlier narrative of made in the image and likeness of God, having godlike powers emerge. We have to have some godlike wisdom and love for how to steward that, or we get destruction. So coming to that and coming back to the generator function topic to then be able to answer your question of what needs to emerge and where do we see it happening. So three generator functions that relate to perverse incentive and relate to debase our substrate in these things, but I'll say them more specifically so that we can look at what needs to emerge as something that can deal with these things. One is we can't keep running rivalrous dynamics with exponentially more power. And so rivalrous dynamics can work fine in nature, but as soon as we get techne, we get the capacity to create massive jumps in power where we can increase our predative capacity faster than the environment can increase its resilience to our predative capacity. We can't keep running it that way. So given that exponential tech is happening and it can't really be stopped, then we have to develop anti-rivalrous systems for the development and deployment of that tech. And anti-rivalrous means a nation state that has its own metrics, right? Like its own balance sheet of its resources, its GDP, its security, its longevity, its healthcare metrics. A nation state that can benefit its people independently of and even at the expense of other nations or the commons is a basis for a rivalrous game. And a corporation that can benefit its shareholders at the expense of other shareholders or the market writ large or the environment, or all the way down to individual private balance sheets and private property type dynamics, are all the basis of rivalrous games. So, of course, they have been very useful for the kinds of progress we have made thus far. They've been so useful that if I say something like problems associated with private property, people freak out in the way that like fundamentalist religious people freak out when I'm talking, saying that their religion isn't the only truth. They freak out because they assume that what I want is Stalin's idea to be instantiated, right? And that we want some dreadful thing called Marxism that was already figured out to be not true. And look, so it's important that we recognize that if we don't understand the nature of the problem well, we can't solve it. If we do understand the nature of the problem well, we might be able to come up with solutions that we've never tried before. Of course, we're not going to suggest previous systems that also sucked. We're going to suggest systems that we haven't done yet that involve new insights and new capacities, but we've got to even define the problem well to know what we're trying to solve. This relates to another generator function that I'll get to, I guess I'll get to it now. So the first one is we got to figure out anti-rivalrous dynamics so that we're not, see, one something else to understand about the rivalry is it's not just us going to physical warfare with each other or competing for economic extraction from the planet or figuring that to increase on profit margins, we externalize more of our cost to the commons in the form of pollution. It's also that in a rivalrous game, true information about reality is a source of strategic competitive advantage. If I know where the gold is or where the water is or whatever as a tribe, then but there's not enough for the other tribe, then I want to hoard that information from ourselves. And because I don't want the other tribe to stumble upon it, I even want to disinform them about where it is, right? And so you'll notice that in any competitive game, any rivalrous zero-sum type game, disinformation emerges, not just withholding, but actually disinforming. It's what a bluff is in poker, or it's what faking left and going right is in soccer or football, right? Like we see it everywhere. And of course, we see it in the history of tribal warfare all the way on to, you know, advanced civilization type dynamics. But the problem is in rivalrous games, multiplied by a world with exponential information technology, we get exponential disinformation capacity, meaning that we can have a Facebook feed that says that ends up having an AI algorithm that optimizes it for stickiness for you, which means whatever hijacks your limbic system the most, which means whatever version of information ends up appealing to your in-group dynamics and your biases and your fear and susceptibility and like that, and totally independent of actual good information. And so if we think about the world today from the point of view of the damage, not just to the physical commons, but to the epistemic commons, because there's incentive to have disinformation. Well, how the fuck can we solve any problems if we don't even know what the problems are? Because the epistemic commons is so destroyed that nobody has sense making. How do you do good choice making without sense making? Well, you don't, right? And so if we ask, well, how long do we have before the coral die off? What will the effect of the coral dying off be? Will they all die off, or will thermally resistant species emerge? Are they dying off mostly from temperature or from pH change from carbonic acid or from nitrogen effluent affecting the phosphorus cycle or from trophic cascades from a loss of the large fish and whale species? So how do we deal with that thing? Why was North Korea about to be in nuclear war with us a year ago and now everything is fine for the first time since the 70s? What the fuck happened? Did they really have tactical nuclear capabilities? How much stuff really leaked out of Fukushima? Is Fukushima solved now? What is the real risk with AI? Elon says it's too late. Bill Gates says there's no risk at all. What we find is that on the most concerning issues in the world that are the most pertinent to the continuation of life on Earth, everybody gives up on sense-making or defects to believing what their in-group believes because it's too fucking hard to actually figure stuff out. And when I say defect, I mean defects on their own sense-making. And so rivalrous dynamics are going to lead to not only physical warfare and economic warfare, but also information and narrative warfare, which the pollution of the epistemic commons through that ends up being a destruction of sense-making and the capacity to even know what a good choice would be, to even know what issues we're trying to make choices in service to. And so, of course, if we have more people with more power per capita, you know, totally, that is increasingly blind, moving increasingly powerfully and quickly, that's not a good scenario. And so here's something I'd mention with regard to this one and sense making is so many people have tried to figure out the vaccine thing, right? Like, wait, are vaccines totally safe or are they totally bad? Or is it like maybe the ones that cure polio are worth it, but not the flu ones? Or maybe the problem was thimerosal, but without the thimerosal, they're fine. Or they try to figure out was Lyme disease a bioweapon, or they try to figure out what really happened with 9/11 or whatever it is, or the current state of AI. And they get so much conflicting information that they just fucking give up.
Yeah.
Right. And they give up on actually making sense of it. But then what happens? You have to say, well, what does it mean to give up on making sense of the world you live in the most consequential topics? Well, it's a form of nihilism, right? It's a kind of epistemic nihilism, because if reality is meaningful, then I need to understand it to know how to interact in an appropriate way. And if I give up on understanding it because it seems impossible or too fucking hard, can I actually make choices that are aligned with what's meaningful if I have no idea what world I live in? And so, you know, something I can talk about what is emerging or not, or what I would encourage, is for people to look at the nature of their epistemic drive and their epistemic nihilism, and like how much are they actually committed to making sense earnestly of the world they live in as a basis to have their choice possibly be meaningful. Come back to that, because I want to finish these generative functions, and I've talked for a long time and you probably have questions. So briefly, we'll say rivalrous dynamics, we got to address. The other thing is intrinsic to how we do problem solving is that for the most part, humanity solves problems in ways that make worse problems. There's not that many exceptions. And whether we're creating a piece of technology to solve a problem, or we're creating a bill, you know, or a political solution, or we're creating a new set of memetics for like a social solution, or whatever, any of the methods we have, a new company for a market solution. So you look at it and you say, all right, well, it was, we were running out of easy big game. And so there was a problem of feeding enough people and whatever. So we figured out the plow. Well, the plow was the awesome for us, but it was also the beginning of massive desertification and having enough surplus that war was really advantageous for other people to come capture our surplus, and the beginning of the types of animal husbandry that led to so many of the problems in the world, and actually the beginning of certain types of fundamental patriarchies. And we're like, wow, a lot of things got fucked up by the nature of how we did the plow thing. And if we, all the way back to stone tools, if we hadn't got stone tools, there'd be no environmental issues, right? Like, we wouldn't have went and became the apex predator in every environment and started extincting earlier species if we hadn't got the wheel. We come to modern time, we say, all right, we have, you know, I think this example is funny, but it's actually a good one. The internal combustion engine to be able to make the automobile was super helpful for us. We could travel further, faster, easier than we could by horse and carriage by a lot. And we were trying to solve the problem of the limitation of horses, that we had to feed them, that they shit all over the place, you know, those types of things. And so the internal combustion engine solved the horse shit problem, right? London was covered in horse shit and the other associated horse difficulties. And that's awesome. And we all like the quality of life associated with cars. But then we look at the proliferation of internal combustion engines that left cars and also went into, you know, tanks and trucks and ships and whatever. And we recognize that all of the oil spills in the Amazon and the Valdez and the, you know, Gulf and whatever, and all the wars over oil and the destabilization of the Middle East forever, and all of the global economy based on the US petrodollar and climate change itself, and all of those issues are the result of the success of solving the horseshit problem. And because what happens is, for us to solve a problem, we define the problem in a narrow way, right? The narrow problem is defined in one or two or five metrics. So we want the carriages to be able to go faster without the limitation of horses or something, right? And so we're working on a solution to that narrowly defined problem, but the solution we create is going to interact with the complexity of the actual world in a lot of metrics that weren't part of what we were designing to optimize. And so we didn't say also in as environmentally sustainable way that doesn't create oil spills and wars over oil. And, you know, we weren't factoring those things. But for the solution to really be a solution to a problem, it has to be larger than the problem. It has to be able to overtake the problem. And if it does overtake the problem, and it solves certain definitions of the problem, narrow definitions, but that it interacts with the complex world where it ends up externalizing harm in other areas, but it's larger than the original problem was, those places where it externalizes harm will probably be larger or more complex. And, you know, another way of saying it is just as humans develop more power, we are just shitty users of power currently, right? So that's coming back to the rivalrous thing, but it's also coming back to the even not rivalrous, just we aren't sense-making well enough to say, if we're making a new piece of tech, are we making something that, even if we weren't doing it for a rivalrous purpose, isn't going to externalize harm because we're being adequately considerate of not just defining the problem in a narrow way, but defining the problem embedding space where we can make sure that our solution doesn't cause worse problems. And so this is a fundamental change in not the nature of whether we're trying to serve a rivalrous goal, but the nature of our sense-making to understand complexity better and to be able to understand the embedding space of our solutions better. So this is another thing at the generator function that we have to address, is we have to define problems in such a way that the solution to that problem is actually omnipositive rather than positive for something and damaging for something else. Because it's not just rivalrous groups, it's also rivalrous metrics, right? A metric based on theory of trade-offs where we benefit something and harm a bunch of other things, and maybe things that we hadn't even anticipated, is going to create inexorable problems, especially as we're as powerful as we are. So there's one other generator function I can get into, but I feel like I've talked for a long time. So maybe I'll take a break now and see if framing things up this way, if you have any questions on it or thoughts before we start to say Well, what is emerging that's actually interesting?
Yeah, well, let's wrap up the generator function like list. Let's finish it, and then I want to respond, and we can explore what's going to emerge. I think that will work well.
So the last one briefly is that the way we have made technology is fundamentally problematic. And you'll notice all three of these relate, but there are distinctions. It's fundamentally problematic independent of how we use it. There's this idea that tech is not good or bad, its value is neutral, and it's whether we use it in service of which values. We can use a hammer to build a house or to, you know, hit somebody as a weapon. This is not true. Technology has in certain fundamental and inexorable effects in its existence that we actually have to factor. And so inherent to increasing power is, you know, the nature of how embedded within a rivalrous game theoretic dynamic, it will lead to the utilization of that power for rivalrous purposes. You can't not use it for rivalrous purposes inside of those dynamics. So that's how it relates to the first topic. That's the multipolar trap, and where if anyone uses it for the fucked up purpose, everybody has to, or they lose by default, and we can't assume that other people aren't going to, so we want first mover advantage on using it for the fucked up purpose, right? Mm-hmm. And but then also, so technology embedded within a rivalrous context will get used for rivalrous purposes. Technology defined in narrow ways ends up causing these problems with the other one. But as we even look at things like the biosphere is made up mostly of six atoms that almost all organic life is made out of, and trace amounts of the rest of the periodic table. But most of the nickel and the chromium and the iron and the uranium and the lead and the mercury is bound in rocks way deep underground, far away from the biosphere. And it actually took geological processes and hydrological and then early biological process billions of years to get it that way. Right? To get the distribution of stuff where we mostly had the organic elements all circling within a very narrow biosphere. So the tree is made of the same stuff that the frog and the gazelle and the lion and the virus are all made out of, right? And as a result of that, when the tree dies or the lion dies, the microbes can eat it, and then the tree can eat it, and so the actual elements of which everything is made are the same elements with similar distribution, and so we can have closed cycle process on it. Now, as soon as we start mining and we start pulling up things that are fundamentally toxic to biology, right? The lead, the mercury, the arsenic, the whatever are all toxic things. We start pulling it up in huge amounts, and then we start doing the smelting and refining where we have both the active product is toxic and the tailings are also toxic, and now we're leaving them up here in the biosphere. We're undoing what took billions of years to make, which was the right elemental constituents for a healthy biosphere. Well, that's a fundamental problem, right? Like, so either we have to make our built world mostly out of the same elements that nature makes stuff out of, or if we're going to use other elements, we have to figure out how to have closed loop atomic cycling on them so we don't have to keep taking them out of nature, and where they don't become pollution. They become like atomically accounted for cycled processes, and where those processes that we create, we can ensure aren't going to break down into the future. So inherent to the nature of something like mining is an inherent toxicity independent of how we think we're going to use the stuff, right? We can give a bunch of other examples of, like, inherent to the nature of an internal combustion engine is it can't not pollute and it can't not depend on resource extraction. It's just built into the nature of the tech. It doesn't have anything to do with what we try to use it for. And this has something to do with making things that are totally different than the evolutionary precedent of the biosphere and of a different kind. We make complicated systems, nature's complex systems. Also, the interface between the complicated and complex is that the complex is anti-fragile. You burn a forest, it regrows. The complicated stuff that we build is fragile. You burn a house down, it doesn't regrow. And so as we are killing more and more of the anti-fragility of nature and converting it into the complicatedness of the human-built world, we're decreasing the anti-fragility of the biosphere and making an increasingly fragile human-built sphere. That's also a collapse scenario. So this doesn't mean we aren't going to have tech, but it means we have to think about it fundamentally differently. We have to think about it in a much more considerate, holistic way, where we're thinking about what is intrinsically the entire effect across the entire supply chain of effect of the development of this tech, not just the really obvious effect of how I utilize it. And so again, this requires a different level of both motive and sense-making capacity to be able to develop it rightly. So now when we look at all of the catastrophic possible risks, whether we're looking at any of the environmental dynamics or social collapse or warfare or unintended consequence of exponential tech, we can see these generator functions underneath and driving all of those scenarios. So then we can say, if we could solve for these generator functions categorically, which means methods for humans interacting that is anti-rivalrous, that is building tech in relationship with the natural world in a metastable way, and that is defining problems in a comprehensive enough way that the solutions don't create worse problems, then we would actually have a human organizational system, a choice-making system that was not driving its own collapse.
Great. So... Thank you, Daniel. I'm having a similar experience that I often have when I listen to you speak, where there's a way in which I feel like I get what you're saying, like on both an intuitive and a conceptual level. Like as you're saying it, I feel like you're pulling me into your world. But then, like the typically, you know, I'm not participating in the conversation. The conversation is on a podcast or something that I'm listening to. The conversation then ends. And I feel like, oh shit, I like understand the problem real well now. And I see like how big and how deep it is for the first time again. You know, every time I hear it, listen to you speak, it's like it onboards this way of seeing again. And it's just like, I almost don't know what to do with that. And there's actually a sense of, in me often, of like helplessness, because now I see the problem and how big it is, how vast it is, and how like, deeply it's encoded into the structure of both the system that I live in, like my civilization, and even my own consciousness. But then like the work of just even reformatting my own consciousness is like real, real hard. And then I think, oh, and we have to do this for a lot of people. And then we also have to do it for all the systems up and down the stack. And I'm like, whoa, that's a like, I guess what comes from that is, you know, I feel like you're in a kind of unique position, and I almost just want to ask you, like, before we get into what you're seeing that's emerging, it's like, are you optimistic that we're going to be able to like do this?
Yeah. So most of us have a kind of learned helplessness, right? Where we really want to help the homeless person that we're walking past. We really actually don't feel good about our busyness to get to something that doesn't matter that much, having us walk past another human that's actually really hurting. And yet there's so many homeless people, and we could spend our whole life doing it that way and not really touch it. And that's just one tiny issue. And there's a learned helplessness where I don't feel like I can keep caring in the same way if I can't act on the care. It's too devastating. And so I start putting blinders on and I start numbing in a particular way, because I can only care about stuff I can do stuff about. And it seems like I can do so. So both my impossibility to respond and my impossibility to even make sense of adequately, well, my impossibility to respond will have me turn sense making off, also my and care off. My inability to even make sense of things will have me turn care off. And so I'll tell you a little bit about kind of my process. I'm sharing some things that I've come to understand, or how I see things, as a result of, you know, a somewhat long curve of really trying to make sense of what the problems are in the world. But
I started with much smaller definition of the problems, right? It was like it started for me that the problem was factory farms. And then it expanded to, no, we actually do fucked up stuff to lots of animals. And then like, and it kept expanding in steps as I would work with it. But at each step, there was a devastation of both how horrific and how huge the problem was. And then based on that sense making and the care, and then there was an up leveling of, okay, well, what could I do to help this? And a kind of agency that would emerge. But then as I would work with the solution that emerged, I would realize it wasn't a real solution because the problem was actually deeper and bigger than I was thinking it was, and I was solving the wrong problem. So, okay, we're going to work and put the fences around the elephant preserve so the poachers can't get to them to protect the elephants. But given that even when we – so we succeed at that, but we haven't addressed the poverty of the poachers who can't feed their kids any other way, and we haven't addressed a macroeconomy that creates poverty because of a power law distribution on wealth, and we haven't created – affected the mindset towards animals, and we haven't affected population dynamics and all those things. And so – as a result, when we succeed at protecting the elephants because the fences go up, the poachers move to start hunting the white rhino that's more endangered and the mountain gorilla, right? This was an actual experience I had when I was 13 working with an activism project. And I'm like, wow, the best solution, because it didn't understand the problem well enough, actually made a worse problem. It moved the harm to a more sensitive area. So then understand a larger definition of the problem and then try to work on a solution there, and that would happen again. And so then that took me on a process to kind of the maximum abstraction of generator functions of all the things, right? But at each step, as there was a deeper understanding of the nature of the problems, there was a while before there was a up-leveling of a sense of agency. Now, if I'm going straight to the most abstract and general case, there aren't all those steps of the up-leveling of agency. And then there's going to be like, oh, fuck, I went from thinking about what I could do with a community garden to, you know, how do we deal with the nature of how human sense make technology differently and rivalrous dynamics writ large globally. And so something I can say is like, so part of my process, this may or may not be relevant for anybody, but part of my process was in facing the actual situation of the world was there were a few vows that I made when I was pretty young, actually, as a teenager. And the first vow was that I would never turn away from the pain of the world. Like decide I'm not going to go to the factory farm when I have an opportunity, or avoid the poor area, or turn off the PETA video, that I wanted to actually see the world that I lived in and what was going on, because I didn't want to be able to live in a blind bubble, right? So that was the first vow. And then the second vow, of course, when you start to do that, it's fucking devastating. And so then the next vow was to feel all of it and not go numb. And then the next vow was to not, if not going numb, not getting stuck in anger and blame. And then the next vow was to also not get stuck in hopelessness or overwhelm. Those were all basically unacceptable choices. Wow. So the first one of, I just won't look at the problems. I will live in a tiny bubble where I get to feel like I'm succeeding while there's massive suffering and torture happening, is a kind of dissociation that makes me as if a sociopath, right? I'm stoked. There's huge pain in the world, but I don't have to care about it. So I'm like, all right, that doesn't work. And going numb, getting stuck in blame or getting overwhelmed doesn't work. So it's like the only fucking way through is to say, I'm going to feel it all. I'm going to recognize that the devastation, the anger, whatever, is a result of love, which is, if I didn't love the animals, if I didn't love the kids, if I didn't love the environment, if it wasn't beautiful to me, I wouldn't care that it was being harmed. But underneath every one of, underneath the fear, the anger, everything is a reality that is so beautiful that I love, which is why I care. So then I trace it back to the love and I feel that. And I also tune in not just to the tragedies that are happening and could happen, but also to the intrinsic beauty and meaningfulness of life. And then I say, okay, I have some agency. I don't have God's, you know, omnipotence, but I have some agency. So what do I do with that agency in service of what I care about? And, you know, every time I meet a nurse who actually really cares
about the people that she's nursing and makes the pain of what they're experiencing when they go to the hospital less painful, has them feel cared about. Like, I feel this kind of existential relief that she's doing that. Or he's doing that. And every time I find someone who is tending to street dogs in Tijuana or anything, even if it's not addressing the generator functions of X risk, like, all those things matter. And for a lot of people, they will understand the big picture and they'll say, I'm glad some people are working on it. I care about all of it, but based on the sense making I currently have and based on what I know how to do, this is where I can actually add value. And the last thing I would want to do is have the nature of my communication say, because those actions aren't totally sufficient for everything, that you would feel less motivated to take them. Fuck no. I want people to feel deeply motivated to do the things that they actually can do that are expressions of their care. And some people will be oriented to the kind of abstractions to say, well, how would we build a new resource provisioning system, a new economics that removes perverse incentive, or a new collective intelligence system that doesn't have some of the failings of our existing governance systems. And so the people who are called to abstractions and to systems like that, awesome. I want you to work on those things. But whatever it is that you're called to, there's a lot of things that actually need to happen. And just because something doesn't meet the sufficiency doesn't mean it's not necessary, right? There's a lot that's necessary. And so, you know, these vows for me, I'm sharing because they're ones that I hope other people take a version of, their own version of, which is, how do I stay connected to what I care about in the world? And how do I stay empowered in my relationship to what I care about?
Thank you for that. That feels really important to presence after the work you did to name the generator functions. And yeah, so now that we have that ground covered conceptually, what are you seeing that is emerging that is sufficient perhaps to base a new civilizational operating system on, or however you want to frame it? Yeah. What are you seeing that's emerging?
It's a very interesting question. In terms of things that are seeable, there's nothing that maps to sufficiency yet. That doesn't mean there isn't progress. So do we see types of collective intelligence processes that could solve problems without making worse problems, and types of resource provisioning that could solve rivalrous dynamics at scale? No, not yet. Do we at least see more people understanding some of these dynamics and taking them seriously in a way they hadn't? Yes. That's one thing that's emerging, is actually just even a higher level of conversation and consideration, which is always going to precede the ability to address the things emerging in that conversation. Now, you know, if we look at things like DAO Stack or Backfeed, that's working on kind of DAO-based governance structures, or, you know, Holochain or other of the groups that are kind of at the front end of the decentralized computing, decentralized governance process that are working on better systems of governance and collective intelligence. Do they map to sufficient yet? No. Are they making progress that is actually meaningful over previous systems? Yes. So that's an example of some spaces that are interesting. As we see more groups starting to explore things like collective intelligence and small group process, and seeing how shared sense making can work better than just the org chart of a corporation or a government or a traditional academic type dynamic, I think the collective intelligence group process space, there are things that are moving in the right direction. It's interesting on the topic of things like the work in psychology or psycho-spiritual development feels like it is both some of the most important and most problematic work happening. Because the software of rivalry is embedded in us, right? It's embedded in our psyche. And so as long as I've got underlying insecurities that I've been trained have to be resolved by getting other people's approval of me in relationship to being better on finite metrics than the other guy, then we just can't work with those types of people to make an effective collective intelligence very well. And trauma is autopoietic, right? The more traumatized I am, the more likely I am to behave in ways that will perpetuate trauma to myself and others. So trauma healing and actually dealing with the underlying bases of rivalrous conditioning in ourself and learning how to have more authentic and effective relationships and communication with other people. This is all super important. The place where, so that's all stuff I'm inspired by. I'll tell you the place where I'm concerned about it is where people actually get overwhelmed by the problems of the world. They seem too big. So they say, well, I'm just going to focus on my own healing and the world will magically shift through the morphogenetic field change as our consciousness elevates. Or the right solutions will kind of magically emerge out of this. And it's actually a way of disconnecting from what they care about in the world and yet feeling some sense of soothing or agency. And so, you know, one thing I would say is any psychology that is helping people actually be more okay with the things they shouldn't be okay with is not good. So helping people just be at peace with institutionalized violence and, you know, broken systems, like I am very glad that someone didn't talk Gandhi in the early days into just understanding that personal development and working on ourselves and becoming the change in our own self was the only thing to do, and to not have, like, to not focus on the British Empire, because that was just an expression of his own upset and unhealed traumas. Mm-hmm. You'll notice that, you know, whether it's Jesus with the Romans and the Jews or Martin Luther King with the current state of affairs regarding Black people, or Gandhi with regard to the British Empire, like they weren't actually trying to just be peaceful with what is. They actually cared about the reality enough that there were things where they're like, this actually needs to change. And I'm interested in the kind of psycho-spiritual development that empowers me to change it, not the kind that is kind of like spiritual opiates.
Mm. Yeah, I've listened to all of your podcasts, all the appearances you've made. I think I've read everything on Civilization Emerging. I think there are a lot of people, like at least in my weird corner of the internet and the kind of subcultures that I participate in, who are kind of like looking to you for answers, solutions, and the way forward. And I guess I'm like curious about you personally. Like, how are you relating? Are you like aware that there's that kind of expectation or that's put on you, or that people look to you that way? And like, what's it like to be that person around such like deeply critical topics?
Well, I feel like, you know, I've had the fortune to spend a lot of time with people that have helped me make sense of the world a lot. And a lot of them, people who don't speak publicly because they're oriented to be making sense of the world rather than other things. And then, you know, been able to bring a number of frameworks together that seem like they are adding useful clarity to the ability to make sense of the world. And you know what? I'm focused on how do we actually design solutions to these problems, but I'm also focused on just, you know, in the last couple of years, starting to share some of these frameworks in a way that can hopefully support, as you're mentioning, an up-leveling of the collective consciousness, intelligence, consideration around these things, so that, you know, not just those of us who are working together, but in a decentralized way, more people are in
formed by the things that I have found useful. And so insofar as some of those things that resonate with me are resonating with other people, I feel happy about that. And, you know, it's interesting. There's something that I think about, like when you're asking the, what do we do? If we think about the psychology of people who have done fundamental pioneering and fundamental invention and discovery, they don't ever get to ask anyone else how to do what they're doing. Right? Like that's intrinsic to the nature of figuring out new stuff, is that you can't ask anyone else how to do it. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't learn from a tremendous amount of stuff and stand on the shoulders of giants. But then if you're Newton, you're standing on the shoulders of giants, you're making sure you've learned those things, but you're also then advancing the edge. And there's a kind of psychology that is necessary to be willing to work at something that nobody can tell you how to do. And that there's no precedent in a history of smart people at figuring out. And it's not hubris, it's just a depth of care that can't turn away. And there's like the, I can't not focus on this. So even though I have no idea if I'll succeed, I still have to be working on it. And, you know, I think that growing up as kids, most of us got most of our praise from doing things that the authorities wanted us to do and that had already been figured out. So we got the right answer to answers in Sunday school that the teachers had already predetermined what the right answer was, or in actual school where we figured out how to spell or math or whatever, or winning a game where the rules of the game were set, or doing the chores where we didn't really have a say in the nature of how the house was designed. And so we get all this praise for doing things that are already figured out that someone else tells us to do. And almost all the times we got punished were for doing something that we wanted to do. And so there's a very deep psychological program that is running that has to be unwound, because that psychology is itself one of the generator functions of the problem. It keeps people perpetuating the existing systems. And so, you know, if someone asks me, well, what should I do? I'm more interested in the meta question of like, how do you... I can share some things with you, and a number of people can share some things with you, but how do you navigate sovereignty in a way that says, when I come to the edge of things that aren't known, how do I figure out what to do? How do I discover stuff as opposed to do stuff that somebody else told me is the thing to do? Like there's a psychological shift there that is really critical. So that's one thing. And coming together with other people that are also really earnestly endeavoring to figure out how to do things that they care about that aren't currently known, and figuring out how to actually collaborate in that together. So how to be in it ourselves and how to collaborate with others in it. And this requires, this actually requires a mature relationship with certainty and uncertainty, where I can sit in uncertainty about something that's really consequential. I don't know how to solve the problems of the world. Yes, it really matters. I don't know how to solve even this particular problem. Yes, it matters. But I can sit in the uncertainty, which also means the uncomfort of it, so that I don't just have to distract myself with something else or default to a quick answer that's the wrong answer because I need some certainty. So there's a psychological willingness to sit in the discomfort of that uncertainty. But there's also a psychological willingness to go through the epistemic process to bring about enough certainty to act. So it's easy for us to be very uncomfortable with uncertainty and want certainty. Fundamentalism of all kinds does that. But it's also very easy for us to kind of do the postmodern move and be uncomfortable with any certainties and be sure that all certainty is imperialism and only need to rest in uncertainty, which means we never have an epistemic basis for good choice. And so a mature relationship to reality knows that there is knowable and unknowable stuff. And within the knowable, there's mostly unknown and some known. And that even the known, my epistemic confidence margin is not 100%. And yet there are better confidence margins than others as a basis for action. And a mature relationship to all that says that I can sit with uncertainty and I can sit with certainty both comfortably, emotionally, so that I'm not being emotionally biased one way or the other. And I can explore what is the right process to bring about a particular confidence margin for the certainty to act. I think that people who haven't received a lot of attention often misassess how uncomfortable it is, and misassess that it'll actually be fun.
Yep.
You know, I had whatever wounded childhood dynamics that created insecurity that sought external approval like everybody does, and figured out my what I can be good at to get approval strategies. And I remember the first times that I was like speaking somewhere that had respectable people respecting me and should have been some kind of success in that way. And I remember feeling really terrible as the people were focusing on being stoked on me because they weren't focusing on actually caring about the issues and what they could do about it. They were focusing on me. And that was like, actually doesn't do shit for me. And I'm like, no, don't do that. I'm talking about these issues because I care about them, hoping to connect to where you care about them. And I have any insights because I have to, because I care about them enough. I keep working on it. And I want to know how we can kind of collaborate together, but focusing on me in a way where you get to say like, oh, I'm glad he's working on that. Like, that's actually dreadful. I think that's kind of interesting. Getting to be part of conversations with people who are really earnestly working on stuff is obviously meaningful. And also getting to be in conversations that increase my sense-making about the world is meaningful. And I will say that, well, you know, mostly I talk about ideas that I'm hoping give people frames to make sense of the world that empower whatever they're doing if we never talk or interact. You know, if there are people who are very called to how do we make new systems and who have developed some capacities in some of these areas, there are things that we're researching that could use support in research. And so if there are people who would like to explore the possibility of engaging in supporting some sense making, send me a message.
Well, thank you so much, Daniel, for taking the time to speak about all this. And as we kind of head towards the closing of the conversation, I'm curious, like, is there anything at this point that's on your heart or mind that you feel like would be good to presence before we close this conversation up?
I really like what you're doing with this podcast, and you know, the fact that you listened to all of the things and read all the things you did and have really worked to make sense and then want to help advance the conversation and are connected to the, you know, it seems like you have a community of people that are all kind of at the front of a bell curve of really trying to make sense of certain things in the world and working, you know, you're working to empower them to do a better job with that. And, you know, when you ask where are there things that are emerging that I feel good about, this would be an example.